All right, tonight, before we get into the great detail of the 11th chapter, there is one specific thing from chapter 10, really it occurs in several of these last chapters, that I want us to discuss, and that is the topic of angels. There are very few things as fascinating as the existence or the knowledge of the existence of heavenly beings created by God to serve in some capacity to the benefit of human beings. Angels made by God to in some capacity serve nations, serve people. And they're not mentioned in every book of the Old and New Testament, but we do have quite a few mentions of them. Before we even get into the references in Daniel, give us a couple of the stories that stand out to you where God has these created beings and they intercede in some way into the life of a human being. Can you think of stories? What jumps out at you when you think of angels? Yes, ma'am.
The angel came to Joseph.
Okay, the angel that came to Joseph. All right, so they would come. At times they would be messengers that would come and deliver the information of God to people. They were the in-between. What else?
The angel that appeared to the father of John the Baptist.
Okay, go so about the name of the child and John the Baptist during that period of time. Yes? Yeah, how about wrestling? Anybody ever wrestled with an angel? The answer is yes, for only one person, and that would be Jacob. Jacob wrestled all night long with an angel. It's a very fascinating. First of all, it's just a really difficult pronoun read. He said to him, and you're trying to figure out who he and him are. But there's an angel that in some way is serving the will of God by physically interacting in a wrestling match with a human being. That's an incredibly fascinating story from Genesis. What else?
Peter in prison.
Okay, we have the story of Abraham and the angels that came, right? In the case of the destruction of the city and all those kinds of things they actually had in their home. You have, what was the other one that was just mentioned? Yeah, Peter in prison, an angel comes to Peter. That's in the New Covenant, under the New Covenant in the New Testament age. And an angel appears and helps Peter escape from prison, leads him right through everything. I think about when the eyes of the servant was opened and he saw the angels and the chariots all across the mountainside. I never forget that scene because it reminds me that angels in a spiritual realm, but right here around us, are active in capacities beyond our description. If we could see in the spiritual, we would see them in the room, perhaps, at this very moment. It's an amazing thought. Paul.
The angel who destroyed the army of Sennacherib.
Yes, Sennacherib. Is that the pronunciation we're going with? Sennacherib. All right. 185,000 soldiers died because of the angel. Yes.
Christ in the dark.
Okay, the angel that came, remember when Jesus asked about relief and that angel was sent and somehow the angel interacted with Jesus. Now, it might be that you would say, okay, those are really interesting stories, but those are all miracle age stories. In the Old Testament, there were supernatural events that took place, and one of those supernatural events was these angels delivering messages and doing all these different things. And even with the case of Peter, you might say, that's a New Testament story, but it's a first century supernatural century story. But there are passages like Hebrews chapter 1. In Hebrews chapter 1, in a letter that likely was written pretty late in the New Testament record, in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 13, talking specifically about angels. They're mentioned in verse 13, they're mentioned in verses 6 and 7, etc. Are they not all ministering spirits sent out to render service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation? Ministering spirits sent out by God, not unlike in our chapters we've been reading, how God sent the angel to Daniel. Ministering spirits sent out to serve Christians, to serve for the sake of those who will inherit salvation. It's pretty amazing. Now, here's the thing about it. As fascinating as it is, we only know what we know, and that's not very much. I hate to tell you this story. It's not a great story, but in a church where I grew up and where I worshiped for many years, there was a man who preached in another country, and we had financially supported that gentleman for several years. And he came as an American, and he came to our church to preach a few sermons. You know, it's always good to hear a guy that you're financially supporting. And he preached all day on angels. And when he was done, they took him in a room, and they canceled his support. He had over-extrapolated guesstivated, in other words, you can just make up that don't make sense, to add all these ideas into what we know angels are doing. And the truth is, you don't know three sermons worth of information on what angels are doing. We have a very limited understanding. But here's what we do know. We know that God made them to serve for our sakes. Maybe not serve you, put your hand out and he put something in your hand, but serve for your sake. And we start to see some of that back in Daniel. In fact, maybe more here in Daniel than you would see in many other places. If I'm back in Daniel chapter 8, who are the two big names, angels, that you hear today when you talk about this subject? Both of them are mentioned by name in the book of Daniel. Who are they? Michael and Gabriel, right? In chapter 8, in verse 16, Gabriel is there. What is Gabriel doing in chapter 8, verse 16? What's his job?
To tell him what the vision means.
He is sent from God by the instruction of God to go to Daniel and communicate to him the meaning of the vision. This is the vision of the sheep and the goat, and he tells him all about that. We have mentioned a little while later in our text, in chapter 10, we get this idea that behind the scenes, and by behind the scenes I mean outside of physical ability, there are all kinds of things, including wars and battles and issues taking place that we don't know about. Look in chapter 10, verse 12. Do not be afraid, Daniel, for from this first day that you set your heart on understanding this and on humbling yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to your words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia was withstanding me for 21 days. Then behold, Michael, one of the chief princes, notice princes and angels, that's a synonym word in that phrase, came to help me, for I had been left there with the kings, plural, of Persia. What does that sound like? Sounds like there's good angels and there's bad angels. We would use the term angels and demons. And it also sounds like there are spiritual beings associated with nations. Now, some might say, and I've read the commentaries that suggested that it had to do with physical kings. It's Darius or Cyrus or one of those guys. Possible, but, you know, Cyrus was actually letting them go at the time. He wasn't battling them. He was letting them go. But there are these princes of the kingdom of Persia. And here is an angel, likely Gabriel here, who for 21 days, figurative or literal, has been battling with these princes. And it is, in fact, Michael's assistance that allows him to in some way persist or get free of it or whatever he needed to do to proceed along with what was next. Verse 20, Daniel 10, verse 20. Then he said, "Do you understand why I came to you? But I shall now return to fight against the prince of Persia. So I am going forth, and behold, the prince of Greece is about to come. However, I will tell you what is inscribed in the writing of truth. Yet there is no one who stands firmly with me against these forces except Michael, your prince." And it almost looks like that Michael, chapter 12, verse 1, is the angel looking over Israel. The prince of Israel, maybe, is Michael. And Gabriel's doing something else. Now, again, possible it's talking about just the behavior of the physical human being kings. Like here, you know, Alexander the Great's coming next, and we'll be ready when he gets here. But it sounds like spiritual warfare between the created servants of God for the sake of nations, like the nation of Israel, and the bad angels, the demons, the servants of the devil, which we know do exist, serving on behalf of evil nations against them. Now, how does it make you feel? This is like a session we're having on a couch. Yes, they may need to do some housekeeping, but I hope that that's true. How does it make you feel to consider the reality of this scene and how it is better than likely that these same entities still exist, that some may be here with you? You have ever heard the term guardian angel? I can't verify that each person in this room has an angel, but I can verify Hebrews 1:14 that they are sent out as ministering spirits for the sake of you. And the idea of national protectors fighting evil, what does it make you think or feel when you consider that that could be existing all around you beyond the scope of your physical vision? Yes.
Come in a little late. You may have already mentioned this, but Hebrews 13:2,
Okay, about entertaining angels unaware.
I do believe that that also means today.
Yeah. Entertaining angels unaware. I walked into a Starbucks today, and there was an older lady sitting there, looked like she was all by herself, and I asked her if she needed anything. And she said no, and I turned around and looked back, and she had disappeared. All right. Most of that story was true. The last part was not true. She was still there. I did let this lady go ahead of me. She saw me go, and then I came back, and she didn't let me back in line. But, you know, it's fine. Maybe that was the angel testing my patience. Yes, sir.
Doesn't the term angel in the New Testament, though, sometimes refer just to a messenger?
It does.
How is it an angelic being versus just a messenger?
The answer can only be one word, context. The only way you know whether angel and messenger are synonyms in terms of Greek language, how you would know. So if I'm in Hebrews 1 and I'm reading that chapter, I can establish that it's a heavenly being based on the comparison between Jesus and the angels all through Hebrews chapter 1. You have these angels, and you have Jesus, and you have these identities. And I'm convinced that Hebrews 1 is angelic beings. I think Hebrews 13 is as well, because it's referencing that event where God sent the messengers, presumably from heaven to Abraham. I may be missing something there on the context, but Kenny hits on something key. Could just be a messenger. Your translators, whether you're reading from the New American Standard or New King James or ASV or this guy named Eugene's Living Bible, we'll get to talk about him one day. They decide based on your translation what they think it is. So if they think it's a human being, they'll put messenger. And if they think it's an angelic being, they'll use angel. So you're getting a little bit of interpretation just by the version you're carrying, but context is always going to be king on that. Yes, sir.
Definition concerning what you're talking about, I think. Angels are servants of Christ, not the church, but for the benefit of the church. That makes sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And again, all I really know to do is quote that verse in Hebrews 1 and 14. Service for the sake of those who will inherit salvation. Yes, sir.
Matthew 18.
Matthew 18:10. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven. All right, good point. Probably they're your angelic beings. They're in heaven, and there seems to be some connection between that person and their angels. Here's the thing. We don't have to be scared of talking about this as long as we don't take one step too many. One step too many is, I'm going to tell you how it works. And I'm going to tell you that each one of you gets your own angel, and he's always on your right, and he has six wings. I can't say that. That's kind of what that guy did that time. You can only go as far as you can go, but I'll tell you what it does for me. It is one of the most humbling, sort of surreal-like feeling to consider all of the spiritually natured beings and actions and persons that are all, you're never alone. You're never alone. These things exist beyond us, not only the presence of God, the presence of Father and Son and Spirit, but these beings who are working and the dark forces that are working. And it makes me, one, completely humbled at how little I am. And two, it makes me want to put every ounce of what I have and every ounce that I can borrow of trust in the God of heaven to protect me. That He has the power to control these things, to manage these things. The stories kind of take on a new meaning when Jesus cast demons into the swine, when He sent them where He wanted them to go. Whatever's out there, whatever I can't see, whatever's happening, my King controls it all. My King controls the angels. My King controls the parameters of the demons. And I can't imagine what it would be like for all those things to exist and for me not to be associated with the King. So I'm helpless at what might be coming. Yes.
Another add to that is Jesus also has the keys over Hades and death, and He's conquered the devil and his demons already.
Okay.
So Jesus is King over everything.
Ultimate victory, yes. Yes, sir.
We need to realize there is a God, and there are angels, and there are multitudes of angels, and those angels are doing something. And we're not exactly told what they are what they're doing. We do know that they interact, that they interact with humans throughout history, throughout the Bible. And so we can't say what the limits of that interaction is, or when it when the miracle ceased, how much that effect that had on it.
But
they're not just sitting idly up in heaven. They are active beings,
all right.
And they're doing something.
The imagery of Revelation can help with that as well. There's a lot of imagery in Revelation, like the bowls of incense being poured out and all these different things that are happening, but it is the angels who are carrying out most of this, who are pouring and picking and moving and hearing. So they're acting in the first century. That's late first century. That's going into the second century of Rome, and they're still active. Now, I would be very careful in that. In Old Testament times, God allowed supernatural events to take place. In the first century, God allowed supernatural events to take place. We have no evidence that God continues to allow supernatural events to take place, because we have the whole reason the supernatural events took place was to get you this, and you've got it. But let's not be, I think we would be at risk of being too limiting. I think that the religious world is at risk of not being limiting enough. Oh, angels are still, let me tell you what one told me the other day. And let me tell you what happened, and let me tell you this, and let me tell you that. And they're not limiting enough. There's a reason why we don't see those supernatural events today, because the full revelation, what's an angel going to tell you? The full revelation is here. But we would be at risk at the other extreme. They do nothing now. They've been eradicated because there's no more purpose. Or they sit in heaven and they hold their hands and they do nothing. I would be very careful of erring on the side of limiting the spiritual world and its activity. But at the same time, being careful to admit what you don't know. Part of it. Josh.
God has revealed everything we need to know, but he hasn't revealed everything. This kind of gets into that. There's all kinds of things we have no idea about because he doesn't reveal it to us. I would imagine part of that is we wouldn't be able to wrap our minds around it.
Yeah, I imagine that's so. We don't have eyes or a brain, or a concept of anything beyond the physical. And so there's only so much we can comprehend. Let's go here first.
Definitely talking about greater than I understand it. You know, when we look at Ephesians and the whole armor of God, it says, well, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against cosmic powers, over the present darkness, against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. So a spiritual daily battle that... maybe we don't know the entire...
Yeah, you remember the text he's referring to in Ephesians chapter 6, that full armor of God, the idea that our struggle is not against flesh and blood. I would say that's a figure of speech we call the not but construction. The truth is you will have to battle flesh and blood, but more than just, that's the idea of the figure, more than just the flesh and blood battles of the people in front of you, there is this spiritual war and this darkness that exists. And only your trust in God and the power of Jesus can overcome it. I think that's a tremendous concept because it further reveals how powerless we are without the power of the King and our trust in Him and how great it ought to be. Yes?
It's interesting, the relationship in Revelation with John and the angels before he fell down to worship them, and they tell them we're fellow servants.
Yeah.
We have a relationship. We're not that much different, but they have a totally different capacity. Role is different from what our role is.
Good points. Good points around the table. Let's get a couple more going, and then we'll get into what he said when he finally started revealing things in chapter 11. Yes, sir.
When we see what we are told in scriptures about these amazing beings, it kind of sheds just a little bit more light on how amazing it is that Jesus is above even them. Okay. Jesus is above them, too. He's been given the name above every name.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And of course, going back to one of our initial verses, Paul, Hebrews 1 is about that. It's about the supremacy of Jesus over every created being, over the angels that existed, that were created, over man, over Moses, over all of it. The superiority of Christ is the theme of the book of Hebrews from the very, very beginning. All right, any other comments on that? Yes.
Personally, or has an angel, you know, they give you a like tire on the way to avoid a wreck that's up ahead or whatever it is, the promise of God takes care of us.
Yeah. That is certainly in Josh's descriptive territory of how tiny a bit we know about that great amount of information. But what's revealed is revealed to increase our trust. And I hope that that's what it does when you read about this. And as for the national stage, which I find to be the most fascinating part of Daniel 8 through 12, is the idea that there may be spiritual warfare, sort of nation on nation. The princes of one country against that of another. All I can say is pray for our country, pray for the spiritual warfare that we cannot see, pray for victory for God's people, and trust that there's more going on than we can comprehend. All right, yes, ma'am.
As we were talking, a thought came to mind, that song, 10,000 Angels, and Jesus had I looked at the scripture. It's Matthew 26:53. It says, do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, that He will at once put in my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?
Yeah.
It doesn't tell us where they are, but He had that at His disposal if He wanted to use it.
Yeah. 12 legions, isn't that 144,000? I think that's where that number kind of comes up later, 12,000 times 12. One story we didn't mention that, I guess two that just sort of wash over me a little bit. One of them is the mountainside, the chariots. Was that Elijah or Elisha? I get them confused at times. Elisha and his servant. His servant said, we're in trouble. He said, check this out. But the other one, and maybe it did get mentioned earlier, what we call Jacob's ladder. It was a vision. Okay, I can see that it was a vision. But in that vision, he saw this ladder going between heaven and earth, and descending and ascending were these angels. This idea of coming down and going up and their presence from there, which is very much what you're seeing in Daniel, where God said, I want you to go down there and do something. And they, you know, Gabriel came down and he did something, and Michael came down. I just really impressed by that idea of what's out there. Yes, sir.
Couple weeks ago, who was venting to me on how they thought it was unfair that we didn't know everything, that God hadn't revealed everything to us, and why didn't He, or why shouldn't He? And I went home and I thought about that for a while, and I think about God did reveal some things to us that, like Josh said, we can't really wrap our minds around, like eternity. I don't know if you ever tried to think about that, but I myself end up with a headache at the end of it.
Yeah.
I think, after thinking about that for a while, that God didn't reveal everything to us because if we knew today that we have the ability to know everything, then we wouldn't seek God. We would seek others. We would seek the people who were immediately around us, like older people or wiser people around us, because they may know the answers. Yeah. We wouldn't be seeking God, and I think God knew that.
Okay. There's a limitation of what we know. I watched a little video the other day, an argument between a Christian and an atheist, and he asked the atheist to draw a circle or something, and did you see that? I forget the details of it, but he said, you know, how, if this is all the knowledge there is to know, I mean, absolutely every piece of information that could possibly be known, come up here and draw what portion of this circle you know. And this atheist or agnostic or somebody got up, I think just put a dot or something. He said, if that's everything that there is to know in the history of everything, then I guess I probably know that. Boop, and he hit a dot. And then he said, so then is it feasible or possible to consider that beyond the scope of what you know could be God, that there's enough out there outside of your dot that God could be there? And the man said, well, yes, of course that's possible. So instantly you shift him over to an agnostic. You're not an atheist. I don't think they really exist, if I could just be honest with you. There's just soapbox lecturers. You don't know is what you're saying. You have the capacity to know. And that's very much the sense with us. And so we have to be careful, right? Because here we are as Christians and we have this book and this is our dot, right? There's this huge circle of information in the spiritual. We get a dot. I mean, if you know everything in the book and you can quote it and preach a sermon on every verse, you got a dot. So we have a interesting weight. We're only allowed to preach the dot because that's all we know for sure. But by faith, we have to stay open to the 99% of the power, majesty, expanse, and incredibleness of God that you do not know. Pretty difficult. But really, in the end, that's where humility and faith just takes over everything. Preach the dot, you're in all of the rest. That kind of an approach, all right? Any other comments or questions about this? Because we're going to get into some really arduous, boring stuff here in a minute. So if y'all want to keep talking about this, that is fine with me. Yes, ma'am.
Well, a teacher friend called me the other day, and she had driven past our house, and she said, man, were y'all's angels working overtime out there? during the tornado. Yeah. And she goes, I don't even understand it. I don't even know why y'all are still there. And, you know, I just told her, I said, I never doubted that. Yeah. I mean, you just walk out there and 360 degrees all around us is destruction.
Yeah.
But then there we were, Matt, Lindy, and me, untouched, and just there was a peace.
Yeah.
Just that he would, all and right. he could.
And he did.
And he did.
He did, yeah, good point. Back here. Yes, sir.
You know, talking about the, what we know, you know, Christ told the apostles, he said he had many other things to tell them, but they weren't able to bear them now. He said, when I'm gone, I'll send the Comforter, and he'll reveal those things. So as they were through the progress of, of their faith and all working and growing, these things were revealed to them that Christ said at that early point they weren't able to bear it.
Sure.
We are more or less like little children. There are things that you don't tell a little child because he is not able to comprehend or to process them. So as he grows, he learns more, and you teach him more, and we're always learning and growing, but if we knew everything, we would be God.
Well, I don't think we have the tools in the spiritual now to comprehend it. Let me finish with Kenny's comment again. I think it's an important thing. If you decide to study this further and you're more interested, just remember, context is always the king on this. Whatever you can learn about it, even the word angel has to be analyzed within the chapter in which it's found. Could very well be. It's kind of like the word apostle, similar, because it's messenger also. Apostle might be the 12, or might just be somebody who got sent out to go deliver a message, like Barnabas the apostle. You have to kind of find out what's going on contextually. All right, any final, I don't want to cut anybody off on this, because we're not talking about angels till like 2035 next. So if anybody has a comment. All right, let's head back over to chapter 11, and we get into a fairly lengthy chapter. It's about 45 verses in length, and chapter 10 was effectively a setup for it. You've been praying. Maybe he had already seen some of this, and I think he'd spent a few weeks sort of contemplating it, three entire weeks, and so the angel comes and gives this explanation. Here's why I haven't been here for the last 3 weeks. I've been tied up with some things, but I'm here now, and so here we go. This is, of all the prophecy you'll ever read in Bible days, this is the most detailed that you will find anywhere. There are some really fascinating ones, like the destruction of Tyre or Tyre and the items being thrown off into the water and all these descriptions of what happened to them holds no candle to what you see in chapter 11. If you have not had a chance to read chapter 11 through, then I want you to do that before Sunday because you're going to have a little bit of extra information to assist you along the way. So what I want to make sure we get around to tonight, if you don't have one of these sheets, we've got some on the back you can take with you. I want you to be considering, normally we wouldn't do it this way. Normally we would read the text, then we would look at some commentary. But in this case, I want you to consider just some historical facts and then go back into chapter 11 and read it for Sunday. We'll get to talk about it. We have about 10 minutes left, but we'll finish it all up on Sunday. Quick question, though, before we get going. Why is there so much detail in this chapter? This king and that king, king of the north and king of the south, and he sent his daughter to marry her son, and they got upset with each other, and then she stabbed him in the back, and they had wars, and all these events and these descriptions, why are these here in Daniel chapter 11? We didn't need all that. I don't think we needed all that. I think ultimately it was just trying to get you back down to Antiochus Epiphanes the IV, who we studied a little while ago. Boy, they got to it a lot faster a couple of chapters ago. Chapter 9, boom, boom, you're there. Here's what it's about. It's about this terrible persecution. But you get a bunch of stuff, 40 verses worth. And really, a lot of it is about Rome, and a lot of it's about the Persians. What's that about, Paul? What do you think?
They're almost done receiving prophecies.
Okay.
There's going to be 400 years of silence. And so Daniel's receiving information that's going to be relevant for the next 400 years-ish.
I like that explanation. What's our date? We're in the late 500s. We're counting down, and so we're in, say, 539, I think. We're getting down to the last 80 years or so of any revelation from God for that period of 400-plus years. You have Nehemiah and you have Malachi, but those are kind of specialized to Israel. But in terms of grand scheme, this is it. And so it's really interesting. Look at the dates. I mean, the things he's going to talk about here are going to take you all the way from about 323. That's early on in chapter 11. You're going to have 323 all the way down to 163. That's a long time that's going to be covered, 150, 175 years. And I think, and I've got a little sell I have to put on you with this, but I think about halfway through this chapter, it leaps forward to first century Roman issues. So he's covering, he's saying, look, let me impress you with the details. Okay, think about this if you're a Jew. Daniel writes out all this stuff, just details. Marriages, wars, all this stuff. That leads us down to 163. And so when I get to 163 and I'm reading this, I am incredibly impressed with Daniel. Man, he wrote this thing 350 years ago and he's been dead on all the way through. Now, what is that going to make me do about the portions of his prophecy that represent the first century that hasn't come yet? What is that going to make me do?
Listen.
Listen very, very carefully. Start teaching my kids, my grandkids, my great-grandkids. There's a period coming when there will be a transition, and here's some of the events that are going to take place. So for lack of a more reverent term, I think he's just kind of showing off here. I mean, it doesn't have to be this way. It is pure evidence prophetic awesomeness. That's the idea. Doesn't need all this stuff. I don't even think this really pertained to too many. I mean, it did some. But it was about showing the power of prophecy. And this chapter is largely why critics of the Bible believe that Daniel wrote, well, Daniel didn't write it, that the author of Daniel wrote it in about 150 BC. Why do they say that? That's too much information. You're too right. You cannot possibly, and really when you read chapter 11, you could not possibly have known this. No way, unless one of two things are true. One thing is, you wrote after it all happened. The other thing is, there's an amazing God who prophesies of incredible future information. So your faith or there's no faith, but there really is not a third option. So this is a lot about that. Let me show you a couple things on your sheet here, getting you kind of warmed up. The history of Israel's relationship to the kings that are going to be in this chapter. Firstly, here's the one that we remember, Alexander the Great. He did not reign very long. You see, it was from about 336 BC to 323. We've already talked about him. This is not a new piece of information. In fact, this comes before chapter 11. In chapter 8, that large horn is on that shaggy goat of Greece. That's Alexander the Great flying in from the west. Here's some secular information, not Bible information, but historical outside of Scripture. 22 years after Alexander's death, Greece was divided among four of his generals. Now, that actually is a Bible concept, if I can get back. Because we saw sort of a visionary description of that, didn't we? We saw that once that Alexander the Great horn broke, that four horns would grow up in its place. Now, what we're learning through history is, back over here, that after about 22 years after his death, that's what happened. Greece as a singularity broke into four pieces, and there are your four pieces. You have the first group that took Egypt, the second group have a region, the third group have a region, and then you have Seleucus who took Syria. Now what I'm wanting you to note here is the middle two, no reference in chapter 11. They're not discussed. Whatever happened with them and however they wore out, it doesn't really have a bearing on what happened to God's people. But the one on the far left of your sheet who took Egypt and the one on the far right become the king of the south, Egypt, and the king of the north, Syria. They're the only two that relate to Israel and they're the only two that are involved there. Now what you have on your sheet here is historical secular information. So these are not details you're going to see in the chapter. This is factual information from their records. Down the left side you have six different kings. They all went by that Ptolemy, sort of like Caesar, except they called it Ptolemy. You have the first one there, and then, of course, a second, and a third, fourth, fifth, and sixth, and it takes you all the way from 323 BC all the way down to 145. You guys all see that down the left. Now, I don't think I did it. I was supposed to put some little stars by 4, 5, and 6, because they actually ruled over Israel. I'll try to fix that. On the right side are your northern kingdoms of Syria, and you have eight of those. Now, the only reason you have six over here and eight over there is because there were just more of them in the same time span. So it's the same time. You have Seleucus there, and you can see they were kind of battling for dynasty. You have some Seleucus and some Antiochus. Then it goes back over to Seleucus a couple of times and back to Antiochus and back to Seleucus. That's sort of a power struggle, I guess, whether it's going to be these guys or those guys. But it takes you all the way down, and it ends, here's the point, verse 35 ends with Antiochus, that evil guy that we saw. So I would suggest to you that chapter 11, verses 1 through 35 is the same vision as chapter 8 and chapter 9. Chapter 8 where the horns broke, and chapter 9 where that evil guy came out. It's just another telling of that in a different kind of form. All right, any comments or questions about the sheet, the chart? All right, what I tried to do beside it, I just stone cold copied that chart out of my Bible. It was in the margin. So what I did of my own imagination is nothing. But what they did is put verses beside the kings. You see how you have 11:5 and 11:6 and 11:7-9. We're going to have to check up on that. I mean, that's what this publisher decided to add in these margins to try to help us understand it. It may not be right. You always have to check it. But they're suggesting, don't you see, that all 14 of these kings are sort of folded all up inside these 35 verses. All right, let's take a look. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 4. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I arose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. Then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And a mighty king will rise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has risen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority, which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others beside them. Okay, that's not that big a deal for us. That is exactly the prophecy that you saw back in chapter 8. I mean, that's it. You've got your kings of Persia, and they're butting their heads in every direction. In flies Greece. In flies verse 3. I put in my margin on verse 3, Alexander. In flies Alexander. He takes them out. But not long after he does, verse 4, it is parceled out in four directions. I have all that there for you on your material. It's just Daniel 8. It's all that's going on there. All right, so let's read a little bit more then. Then, here's new information. We haven't seen this in Daniel yet. So we have these four sections. Then the king of the south will grow strong, along with one of his princes, who will gain ascendancy over him and obtain dominion. His dominion will be a great dominion indeed. After some years, they will form an alliance. And the daughter of the king of the south, Egypt, will come to the king of the north, Syria, to carry out a peaceful arrangement. But she will not retain her position of power, nor will he remain in his power, but she will be given up along with those who brought her in and the ones who sired her, as well as he who supported her in those times. And I'm going to stop right there. Basically, there's 30 verses like that. I'm going to leave that to you between now and Sunday to just look at the chart, see how we have the marriage there, the marriage between number 2 on the left and number 3 on the right. That corresponds to what you just read in 11:6, that there's a wife sent between. I'm going to leave all that to you. When you come back on Sunday, you will have read through chapter 11 and tried to kind of get a grip on the story. And then we will quickly ask if you have any questions. And then we're going to look at the second half of chapter 11. Look, there's not a whole lot to commentate on. It's just details of history between Greece and Rome. Greece's rule and Roman rule. So let's pick up on that next time. Thanks for your participation tonight. If you have anything more,